Okay, we are recording. It is July 27th, 2022. This is Jen Brown, and I'm here with Phil Blackmore for the Baffin Bay Oral History Project. So to begin, do I have your permission to record?
You do, yes.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah.
So since this is an oral history, can you tell me more about your background and early life?
Well, I've lived in, my dad was in the Navy, so we traveled around quite a bit. I've been in Corpus Christi since 1973. I've been an avid fisherman since that time or before. Started fishing the Baffin Bay area in about 1980, 81, something like that. I have done several different things, including played on the PGA Tour and the PGA Tour Champions. I've been an assistant women's golf coach at the University of Texas at TAMU CC. My wife was the head coach. I am a televised golf announcer for different networks. Done some golf instruction, but fishing has always been my passion.
And how did you get into fishing?
My dad was an avid fisherman, and so as kids in Southern California, we used to do a lot of bass fishing out there, and then when we moved back here to Texas, we did a lot of saltwater fishing.
Can you tell me what the fishing was like back then?
In Baffin specifically, or just kind of everywhere?
Everywhere, yeah.
Well, fish were more plentiful. You know, if you go back into the 70s and early 80s, fishing, they were more plentiful. You could go up pretty much anywhere and find some fish. There were not as many people on the water. Down south in Baffin, the water clarity and quality was a little bit better, I think. But it still got crowded a little bit on weekends. But it was a little easier back then to find fish. That's the biggest thing.
And what sort of tackle did you use?
Well, starting back when I was in high school, we threw live shrimp quite a bit and also fished at the Naval Air Station with a silver spoon and some different lures. And then I gradually progressed into just throwing lures only. And by the time I got out of college, I was strictly a plugger, through plugs. And then in the mid-90s, I got into fly fishing and have kind of done a combination of both since that time, although right now I'm in a fly fishing phase where that's all I'm doing. But over the years, I've done quite a bit of both.
Can you talk about that progression of why you were interested in lure fishing and then fly fishing?
Well, it got to be a pain getting bait, for number one. But it just seemed the reason that I fished was because I was competitive. I was a professional golfer. Fishing to me was an extension of that competitiveness. And I didn't fish. I wasn't the kind of fisherman that would just go out and just sit around and sit, you know, troll or just sit. I didn't like bait fishing because it wasn't as proactive. I enjoyed the aspects of trying to learn where to fish, what time of year, on what tides, what time of day, what to throw, the whole puzzle that is lure fishing and trying to get to know the water. And to me, that was, I kind of approached it competitively. So when we went fishing, we started really early and we fished till mid-afternoon nonstop. We didn't take a break. It was all, you know, just real hardcore fishing. And I just, that kind of fit my approach to other things and also fit my golf career.
And how did you get into golfing?
My dad was a very good player. He was he won the All-Navy in the inter-service one year. He was a really good player, won the Texas left-hander 6 times. So he introduced me to golf when I was young, 6 or 7 years old. Played baseball a lot growing up also, and then I gravitated just to golf because being an individual sport, I liked baseball. You could either rely on your team or your team was relying on you, and golf, it was only you, and I liked that, where it was just you. So not only did you share the glory if you did well, but it was also the burden of defeat. It was all yours if you didn't play well. And I enjoyed that responsibility in trying to fulfill those shoes, if you will, of playing an individual sport.
So how did you go from just growing up and golfing and playing all these sports to getting into the PGA?
Well, that's a long story. It was really luck. I played at a junior college for a year. I had been recruited to go to the University of Houston back when they were really, really good. And then I switched the tables. I always wanted a good education, so I felt like I could get a better education at the University of Texas. And so I went there. I played golf there for 3 years and was fairly successful. It was all Southwest Conference there. But I never had any aspirations to continue on. And I started working as an internal auditor in a bank the day after my last final and did that for a year. And while I was there, my uncle was in the oil business, was doing particularly well at that time. Oil was going up at that time, not down. And he talked me into playing small tournaments, mini tours are called in golf. And so I quit my job and started playing golf and went to the bank and borrowed some money to play on. And it just kind of progressed. And it took me a while to get out on tour. And so I drove a Coke truck one winter. I fixed golf clubs one winter. I did different things in the winter to make some money. And I didn't make it through to the tour. So then I went to work at Padre Island Country Club as an assistant pro. And I had a kind of a cool job where Tuesdays, Thursdays, I had to be in early, but Wednesdays, Fridays, I didn't have to be until 10 o'clock. And so I used to go fish in the mornings and then show up for work at 10 o'clock. I just changed clothes, take a shower. I fished a lot out at the Mustang Island Park out there at the beach. Did a lot of fishing out there, caught a lot of trout out there. And then we'd come in and go to work out there. And then fortunately, while I was working, I tried to get through what they call the Q School. You had to get the qualifying tournament they had, and I made it through Q School that year and been on tour ever since.
And as you're golfing, you were also fishing the entire time?
Yes. I was fishing all the time here. I was fishing on the road. I took a fishing pole with me. I'm known as being one of the better fishermen on tour. There's a lot of really good fishermen on tour. Fishing is a very popular it's a popular sport for golfers. I think it's a great way to get away because when you're playing on tour, you're always on display in front of people. And when you're fishing, you can get out and get away. Yet you can still take a competitive approach, as I mentioned earlier, to the sport. So I enjoyed that. And on tour, there's a lot of great fishing. And I even fished at Augusta where they have the Masters. I fished there on the par 3 course, caught some bass there. That's a picture. It's around here somewhere. Where'd it go? Up at top up there. That's my dad behind me, caddy for me, the first Masters I played in, fishing on the par 3 course up there. Wow. And they had at Doral, which is in South Florida in Miami, they used to have a fishing contest that ran from Tuesday through Saturday. Whoever caught the large bass got their room paid for the year, and so for that week. And I won that five times. Won it on a fly, actually, one time. On a white deceiver, too. So, I've always been very passionate about fishing. I fished in the Keys. I've done some river fishing for trout, not a lot, a little bit. Mostly I've bass and saltwater.
So where are your favorite places to golf and to fish?
Golf is hands down would be Scotland or Ireland. I love it over there. The people are great, and the game itself is different over there. It's you don't really have that style of golf course and playability here in the United States. We just don't have the soil and the conditions to have that type of grass and to have all sand like that. So it's very unique. I enjoy links golf. And fishing, I enjoy Corpus Christi quite a bit. It's nice here because we don't have any tides to speak of. We have very small tides. If you go over to the East Coast, you get a 3 to 5 foot tide, and it can be dangerous. It can be hard to get in real shallow because I like being able to see what I'm throwing at for the most part. And when the water moves that much, you either run out of water or you get too much water, very quickly as the tides change and move. But any place else, I've enjoyed the Keys. It's pretty fun to fish there. The Bahamas, I fished there a little bit. It's fun. Bonefish, permit, tarpon. I've never caught a tarpon sight fishing. I've caught a couple small ones just in lakes. I caught one down in Puerto Rico down there. I caught a few down there. But probably that would be my next bet. I enjoy fishing in the Gulf with a fly rod, too. I catch cobia in the fall on the fly rod.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
So you talked about your progression to artificial lures. How did you go from there to fly fishing?
Well, Loomis made golf shafts for a while. They got into making golf shafts back in the early 90s. And if you use their golf shaft, they would give you credit towards any of the fishing equipment that they made or to go on trips with them to different places. And I tried their shaft. I really liked their shaft. I ended up winning the Houston Open using one of their shafts. And so I had a buddy that got into fly fishing that we had a fall trip. I had a few guys from tour would come down, and we have a cabin. And at that time, we were borrowing a cabin, and we go fish for a week down in the lagoon. And he brought a fly rod, and I made fun of him and laughed at him. And he wasn't a very good caster either, which made it easier to make fun of him. But after that, I thought, I had some credit. And I thought, well, let me just get a rod and try it. So I got me a fly rod, and I decided that if I was going to do it, I needed to learn to cast first, because I saw a lot of people trying to fly fish, but they weren't very good casters, and that looked kind of miserable. So I devoted myself to trying to learn how to cast decently and got where I could. And it just all of a sudden, it just became something I really enjoyed, the challenge I really enjoyed. And then lately, I've gotten into just really refining my casting skills, a fellow, Larry Allen, who competes, he's on the board of the American Casting Association, and he competes internationally, fly casting and casting both. He's getting right now training for the World Championships in Norway, which are in September. He has his place down in Port Mansfield, where he spends half the year. He's been kind enough to help me to try to refine my skills to get even better. So I like to tell people in golf, if you're a scratch player, that you're a really, really good player. If you play professionally, you're what's called as a plus handicap. If you're an amateur, you're a negative handicap. And I like to say I'm a negative one or two, trying to be a plus one or two. And he's helping me quite a bit. He's changed my stroke quite a bit.
How would you compare the skills you need for golfing compared to fly fishing?
It's very similar. It requires a lot of patience. There's a lot of timing involved in both. Golf swing is a little more dynamic than throwing a fly rod. There's more things moving, more rotation. If you get into maxing out for distance fly rod, some of the competitive distance stuff, it becomes more dynamic. But the main things are in golf, even though today's science seems to make it more complicated, there's really only a few fundamentals. And the rest of it is style and then it comes down to timing and sequence, getting the right sequence. And fly fishing is the same way. There's only a few mechanics to it that you really need to know, a few fundamentals. The rest of it is style. There's different ways to throw it, but it comes down into sequence and timing and rhythm. And so in that way, it's very, very similar.
That's interesting. So you're a family man too, so you're also, I don't know how old your kids are, but can you talk about... having a family and teaching your kids to fish and that sort of thing?
Well, all my kids grew up fishing. I have two older daughters and then two sons. And everybody fished. And the girls, my oldest daughter's a swimmer. My youngest daughter was a volleyball player. And while they'll still fish a little bit, they didn't really take to it like the boys did. And the boys did quite a bit. My oldest son just loved it until he got to be 14. And then he kind of gravitated more towards surfing, skateboarding. He felt fishing was too easy because we always caught fish. So that'll come back to haunt him a little bit now that he's a father. And then my youngest son, very competitive, was a really good baseball player, was a 5A player of the year at Carroll back in 2010. They won state. He went on and was drafted. He played minor league baseball for 6 years, was a pitcher. He has since quit, got his degree at ANMCC, and then he has recently just graduated the fire department program. So he's a fireman, paramedic fireman, and he still loves to fish. He likes to fish competitively, likes to fish tournaments, that kind of stuff. So he's a very, very competitive fisherman and really, really good. They both are. So, and they both throw a fly rod good, but they mostly throw either a plugging rod or a spinning rod.
Do you have a family competition going for biggest fish?
No, but we normally will have a $5 or $10 bet on either most fish or biggest fish when we fish. And the three of us will, all we do is sight fish for the most part. And so we'll rotate. I have a little small platform in the front of my boat. Two of us will fish off the platform and one of them will stand on the center console. And when somebody catches a fish, if they're on the platform, they got to rotate back to the center console. And as I've gotten a little bit older, I could always see fish pretty good, but now my youngest son sees fish way better than I do, and my older son sees it a little bit better than I do, so it puts me at a disadvantage. But it's a proud disadvantage, if you will.
Yeah. So let's shift to Baffin Bay a little bit. Why do you think, or what makes Baffin Bay special?
Well, for the longest time, it was the quality of the fishery, the size of fish and the number of large trout. Size of trout and the number of large trout that came out of Baffin Bay were pretty much legendary on the Texas coast. And the state record, the state record for the past probably 40 years have come somewhere from the Laguna Madre. And Mike Blackwood, who I know, still fishing, 81 years old, still fishing. Saw him a couple weeks ago. You know, he had the state record for about 20 years and a little over 20 years. And it was broken by... And he caught that fish in Baffin, and then it was broken by a fish caught in Baffin, and then ultimately it was broken by a guy who caught a fish down at Port Mansfield, which is still in the lagoon. So that's the biggest part. The next part is that the shallowness of the water and the water, the structure in Baffin Bay, you have the rocks, what they call the world worm castings, but they're rocks, they're hard as can be. So you had structure, you could center on, particularly in the spring with the rocks. A lot of depth changes and shallower water that allowed you to fish for them shallow. Most of the other bases you had north in Texas, you have maybe some coastal features, but then it just goes out into just a mundane kind of nothing in the bay, or maybe some oyster reefs, you know, that sort of thing. And Baffin's very, very different in that regard. And it also, because it was so remote for a long time, it took a while for all the people to really get down there, for technology and boat motors and that sort of thing to get where people wanted to go that far to go fishing and that expense. And so it was, the remoteness allowed you to do some sight fishing for trout that you really couldn't find anywhere else on the Texas coast. And so I think so those features, that uniqueness and the chance to catch a fish of a lifetime, really drew a lot of people to the area and made it pretty famous.
What does the place mean to you?
Well, I've got some great memories. I was for a while there, I was really hooked on trying to catch a big trout. And that was my primary focus, my fishing. And I was fortunate enough I was pretty good. And I had a job that when I got home, I could fish during the week. I didn't have to wait for weekends, which was a nice plus. And we were pretty serious about it. We would go down in the middle of the night a lot of times. We'd launch the boat at 12, 1, 2 o'clock in the morning. This is before GPS. So we would run off compass headings. And you had the intercoastal. You could run with a Q-beam down the intercoastal. Once you got to Baffin, there was a series of markers that went into the Baffin. But once you got past the first three, you couldn't see the next one with the Q-beam. So we'd just run off the compass to get to where you could see the next one and get to where you could see the next one. And then we would run to a particular, we had one area we liked to fish more than any others, and we would run to a particular marker, number 14, and then we'd run on a 330 compass heading until we could see the shoreline with the Q-beam. And we'd hit the shoreline, turn left, go down the shoreline until we ran past a duck blind and we saw the old broken down pier. And that's where we would stop and idle out a little bit and get out there and wait on a 140 compass heading. So that puts you right where you wanted to be on this point, the East Clayburgh Point that had these rocks in it, and there was one particular area that I liked to fish more than any other. And we would take broken backs and mark them black with a marker. So when you had a little bit of moon, you would have a really good silhouette. And we caught a lot of really big trout in the middle of the night down there doing that. And at 8 o'clock, all the boats would start showing up and we would leave and go around the corner right there into Alazan Bay, which comes right off of Baffin Bay. And we go back in there, which back then didn't get a whole lot of pressure. And I had some great trips back there too. So my dad and I did a lot of that together. And then as my boys got a little older, we did a little bit. So it's been just a tremendous source of memories and experience for me and my family.
Can you tell me some of these fish stories or what your most memorable experience has been down in Baffin?
I won't have enough time to cover them all. One pretty funny one. I caught two trout. We caught a box of trout in December of 1988. We had a freeze in 83, and then it took 3 years for the quality of the bigger fish to really show up, or for the fish to get that big again. It took about 86 before you started catching fish 28 inches or over. In 88, I had a particularly good year. I caught six trout over 32 inches, 32 inches. And two of them, we caught some fish in December. They were feeding on mullets. They were particularly heavy. And we filled up a cooler with trout that were 27 inches and over. I caught two of them. One weighed 10.7, one weighed 10.15, and had those mounted. And we got back and started cleaning those. And I'm like, why did we keep all this fish? What are we thinking? And so that, for me, was the turning point where we started letting fish go. We would let the big fish go. We would keep some small fish to eat. And that was it. And I had a boat rule. You couldn't keep a trout over 25 inches unless you gut hooked it and was going to die. Or if it was a trophy and you want to mount it, fine. And so a friend of mine, Ed Fiore, came down, and another from San Antonio, and we went down in the dark to fish in Baffin, East Clayburgh Point, and a big thunderstorm came up between there and Bird Island, so no one could get down there. So we're down by ourselves. And about 8 o'clock, we hadn't caught any fish. And I just told them, look, we got to wait another half hour. Ed, you go stand on that rock over there. John, go over there. If they don't show up in the next half hour, then we'll go back into Alazan and do something different. And then Ed's sitting out on that rock, and you hear him say, "They're here." And he's standing on that rock. He could see these big trout swimming in out of the bay up onto that point. And we caught, I estimated we caught 40 or 45 trout over 25 inches that day, that morning. And we only, out of all the fish we kept, we only kept five fish total. And Debbie, Ed's wife, they were staying out on the island at a hotel, at a condo. And we went out that night to meet them for dinner, and Debbie was hot. She was mad. She loved to eat fish. And she's like, "Well, I come down here to catch fish. Ed catches fish. You don't let him keep any. We don't have any fish to take back. You kept five fish total between three of you. What are we going to do?" And she was hot. She chewed me out pretty good. And I said, "Debbie," I said, "it's my boat. It's my rules. Ed has a boat. If he wants to go down there and catch fish, he's more than welcome to." So that was pretty. Her reaction stuff to that day was, I'll always remember that. But that was a great, you know, that was a great day of fishing for sure. But we had a lot of experiences. I know my dad and I were running one night before GPS. We left East Clayburgh Point and we weren't finding anything. It's about 4 a.m. And I said, "Well, let's go fish. We'll go fish Cathead," which is about 5 miles back the other way. So I'm leaving an area full of rocks, going to another area, shallow, full of rocks. And it's dark, and there's no markers. There's nothing. It's just darkness. And I think I know the compass heading to get in the general area, but I don't know how far it is. And my dad's like, "Well, how are you going to get there?" I said, "I think I can feel it." So here we go. We're running across the middle of Baffin. Of course, we got our running lights on. And all of a sudden, we get pulled over by the game warden. He stops us. And they got their guns out, thinking we're running drugs or commercial fishermen running nets or something. And we've got, there's six rods in the rod holders, or eight rods or something in the rod holders. Like, "What are y'all doing? We're wet from wading, and we got all these rods standing up. Well, what's it look like? We're fishing." "Well, we just don't see many people down here running this day, you know, this time of night." "Well, we're going fishing." "Where y'all going?" "Well, we're going over to Cathead." "How are you going to get there?" "Well, it's, you know, running on a compass heading, kind of feel it, unless we hit something. Hopefully we won't hit something before we get there." And okay, you know, good luck to y'all. So that was their reaction to seeing us. It was pretty funny. Not many people did that back then. So yeah, we had a lot of fun down there.
Did you ever run into any problems running that night?
No, we were very fortunate. We took a lot of care when it was light, tried to take notice of any sort of features that we would need to pay attention to when running in the dark. Tried to get a feel for the amount of time or this, that, and the other. And when you don't have a GPS, it's like driving in your car, running a GPS. You can go to the same place if you're in an unfamiliar area, plug in an address, and you go to the same place 3 days in a row. Fourth day, turn off your GPS and see if you can get there. And so often you don't pay any attention. You have no idea. "Well, I don't know where to go," because you just basically mentally go to sleep. You just follow what your GPS says. Well, the same thing goes for navigating on the water. I think that when you don't have that to rely on, your senses are much more alert, you pay attention a whole lot more, and you are capable of doing a little bit more, I think, than not to say you can't make mistakes and things can happen, but you're just more alert and you can kind of figure things out a lot of times.
That's interesting. You mentioned the 83 freeze. Can you talk more about the changes that you've noticed to Baffin over time?
Well, it has to do more with water quality than anything else, than certainly the pressure, the amount number of fishermen on the water, and the number of fish, too, certainly has changed. But the water quality changed the bay more than anything else. The 83 freeze was really bad. It was much like the freeze of, was it 2020 that we had?
21.
But it lasted, the effects lasted a lot longer. I mean, there were no fish to speak of in the bay in 84. I mean, it was a really cold freeze. And it just devastated. And the number of fish that we saw down there on the banks and stuff, big trout, you know, big redfish, was just devastating. And then the fishery came back. And then we had another one in 89. And that was a really bad one also. And with 89... it killed all these fish, and then early in the spring, we had a lot of heavy rains, and the farmers had fertilized in the spring, you know, get their crops going. There was still, I think, all this material, you know, from the dying fish or dead fish in the water, probably a lot of stuff left over from that, and I think it killed a lot of the zooplankton or whatever they're called, phytoplankton and all the smaller organisms. And the brown tide started that year. That was when the brown tide started. And where Baffin used to always have this gorgeous water, I mean, the wind blew, it'd get muddy, but if it wasn't too windy, the water was this beautiful sandy green. You could see the rocks under the surface of the water. You could see the drop-offs. You could see the potholes. It was beautiful. With the brown tide hit, then for the next 5 years, you couldn't see 6 inches in the water. It was this nasty brown look. And it totally changed fishing for me. I went from fishing for trout. I didn't like to just blind cast at the water. I wanted to see structure, something to keep me excited. So with that, I went shallower and I started strictly redfish after that. So I started fishing in a foot of water or less so I could see redfish. So you could see a tint of red or maybe a tip of a tail or whatever it might be. And so I really got away from trout fishing as a result of that one. And that brown tide was really bad for 5 years. And then it started coming and going. You'd have 1 year where it would be free of brown tide and the next year it would be back. Or you'd have zones with brown tide. And so the water quality really has changed quite a bit. And it's still not normal down there. You have a lot of good water, but it's not what it was. And a lot of the seagrass suffered because of the lack of sunlight. So a lot of areas that it had great seagrass every year didn't. Like this year, even this year, I haven't been down there in a couple months, but the south shoreline of Baffin didn't have any grass. That whole shoreline, it comes out, you know, 200-300 yards, it comes out and then it drops off, goes from shallow to 4 to then to 6 feet of water. And that drop off out there, there's a little gut that runs along. It's really good sight fishing and good fishing. It runs the entire south shoreline all the way back in, 15 miles back in there. It curves around and stuff. And I went 300 yards into the bay looking up there and I turned around and left because there was no grass at all. And when there's no grass, if there's any breeze at all, it just turns to mud. And so that's been, I think, a big change that I've seen. And in addition, there's just been so many people.
You mentioned the fishery and not as many fish or not as many big fish. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that?
Well, I think that the combination of the freeze and, you know, we've had a lot of great fishing come back after the freezes. And a lot of big trout have been caught after the freezes. And big redfish, too, particularly back in the back certain times of the year. Biggest redfish I ever caught was what I consider part of Baffin Alazon Bay and the other couple fingers back in the back that go back there. I consider that all part of Alazon Bay, which is really part of Laguna Madre. And I caught a 47-incher back there, a sight cast, not on a fly, plug and rod, but in shallow water. It's pretty cool. The number of fish, of course, we had back in the 70s, there's a lot of gill netting that went on. And I was talking to a fellow last night that used to commercially fish. He didn't gill net, but he commercially fished for redfish and drum. And he said that the stuff the gill netters would bring out of the bay down there was just unbelievable. They'd sink boats trying to get so many fish back. And then they started eradicating the nets, I think it was in the mid to late 70s. And by the early 80s, they'd gotten rid of most of the nets. You still find one every now and then, but it was pretty much gone. And so the 80s was until the freeze in 83, late 70s, 80s was a great time. And then from about 86 or 87 until the freeze of 89 was a great time. And then in the 90s, there was a really good stretch there in the late 90s where there was a lot of really good, like Scott Murray probably told you a little bit about that. Since then, you know, I only fish Baffin in the winter now. And because the other thing is all the spots, you didn't have GPS. And so you buy a NOAA chart that had the rocks on it and you'd try to plot them and you'd find it and you'd try to triangulate, you know, looking for windmills and stuff on the bank. And, you know, here we are, you would time it off of a certain mark or something, trying to find it. You could have a depth finder and maybe find it on your depth finder if you wanted to, so that changed with GPSs. And then Google Earth changed it even more. There are no secrets anymore. There are no secrets. And so the spots we had that we had worked really hard to figure out how to get to in the morning early, how to find them, which spots to fish, which times of year, they're not secrets anymore. Now you go down and you get covered up with people. So that's changed quite a bit also.
Did you ever have any run-ins with commercial fishers?
No, I've had more with guides than I have with commercial fishermen.
Oh, yeah? Tell me about that.
Well, the guides, I think some of them kind of treat the water as if it's their own and not, you know, recreational fishermen as well. And I understand they're trying to make a living, but at times they can get a little carried away. And certainly recreational fishermen can be pretty stupid and do things as well. But I've had a couple instances where We were wading at East Clayburgh Point, three of us out there, and we're two of my buddies, or me and a buddy, we're no more than 50 yards apart at the most, so 150 feet, which isn't very much, and guide drifted and came right in between us, which I thought was pretty rude. Had another deal down in the hole where this particular guide that was known for doing this sort of thing, we were on a big school of redfish in the north end of the hole, and we'd fished them that weekend, and we were down there on Monday. I had a friend in from out of town, and we're just making a long drift, just kind of drifting our way up to where the school was, and it caught a couple on our way up there. It's a beautiful morning, and here he comes and goes in and does a circle around him, behind him one time, and then another time to herd him, like rodeo him, and then he comes back, and he gets all his guys out and lines them up to wait for him to come by. And I'm like, how stupid is that? And certain things ensued after that. Even had one out at in the Gulf last year, I think it was. Me and a friend went out. We had two different boats out there, and we were sitting on a wreck. There was no other boats around on this wreck that we were on, and we were trying to see if we could catch snapper on a fly rod, trying to see if we could get them up enough and could catch them on a fly rod. And I'm just blind casting. I've got a 10 weight, I think, or a 9 weight that I'm using, you know, and a pretty heavy fly with a 6-aught hook on it. And here comes this boat idling up, and there's two of us. Actually, there were three of us, three boats, all friends sitting there. And here comes, and we're spread out about, you know, a couple hundred feet apart, you know, on this thing. And we've just got our trolling motors on anchor, so we're not going anywhere. It's not drifting. We're just sitting in one spot. And here comes this boat idling up, and I'm watching. I'm standing there on the boat, in the front of the boat, and I can't believe what this guy's doing. And he keeps coming, and he keeps coming. And he got about 70 or 80 feet away. I cast my fly into the bow of his boat. There were two of them on the boat. Luckily, my fly didn't stick to anything. That would have been awkward. And they looked at me, and I said, you know, if I can throw my fly in your boat, you think maybe you're too close? One of the guys, pretty embarrassed, said, yeah. And they turned around and left. That was that could have been interesting.
Well, that's nice.
It's not baffin, but it's the same idea.
Yeah, so fishing pressure, GPS, and what about changes? Have you noticed any changes to the crabs and shrimp and that sort of thing over time?
Yeah, the shrimp. I mean, I don't fish it as much as I used to, but I talk to guys still. And we used to have, particularly the crabs, I'm not sure. The shrimp in particular, there used to be a great shrimp run in the fall that we fished. And after we'd have a big cold front, a good cold front would come through, and it would lower the water level, and the shrimp would start heading out. And you had about a 4 to 6 week period there where you could fish under the birds. The birds would be working over the schools of shrimp, whatever you call them, coming out. And we came up with a pattern where that if you fished after the front, but when you still had a little bit of north wind, we caught bigger fish. We caught nice fish under the birds. I mean, up to 8 or 9 pounds. I mean, nice trout. And then once the wind died, slacked off, or came back out of the southeast, the size of fish got a lot smaller. And we did that a number of years. I mean, that was kind of one of our fall kind of deals we look forward to. And we don't see... we'll see the birds working anymore. And I'm not down there enough now anymore to know if they might work a little bit on occasion, but I've talked to different people and asked them, and I've not found anyone yet that says, yeah, the birds are still working down there. So I think the number of shrimp and whatnot are significantly less than what they might have been at one time. As for crabs, I don't really know. You know, the redfish are full of the little small crabs that they eat. As far as the blue crabs, I don't have any idea. Mm-hmm.
Has your fishing tackle, the types of lures you use or the types of flies you've changed over time?
Yeah, I'm a little sick in that regard. I've got a box I gave my boys and a box out in the garage about the same size. I've probably got at least 1,000 or more lures in that one and the other one. I mean, I like lures, like messing with lures, different colors. The thing about trout are that they can be very color specific at times. We used to, after the 83 freeze, my dad and I were fishing in the surf, and we were catching a lot of really nice trout in the surf at Mustang Island. And we had a particular mirror lure that we were using that was a custom order. It was a pink head with a yellow body and a gold flash. And there's a very similar, there's an orange head on the market, and there's a red head one on the market with the same body. But we stood right next to people with that pink head. They had the red or the orange, which you could buy over the counter. And we would outfish them 10 to 1 with that lure in the surf. And so because of that, I've always carried a lot of different, if I find a lure that I like, I will have it in a lot of different color patterns, because at times it seems the trout will be very color specific. Redfish, not as much. Redfish, I like to tie different things, just messing around to throw a fly rod at, just piddling around. But if I had to catch a redfish, you just throw a chartreuse and white clouser, and if you make a good cast, you'll catch it. Particularly in Lagoon, you go up further north where they're really, really spooky because they get so much boat traffic. I used to have a little kind of miniature imitation tarpon fly that I tied with the feathers splayed on the back in a black and white pattern that they really liked. But I enjoy messing around with different flies for the redfish because I'm just not as, I like to say, mad at the fish anymore. I like to catch them, and I'll keep a couple to eat, but I don't freeze them. I don't give them away. You know, it's just more fun how you catch them than what you catch. So I like to tie little floating flies, little mullers and that sort of thing, and watch them try to come up and try to eat them on top, which they miss it a lot. They'll make a bow wake when they come up, and that wake will push the fly forward, and they'll miss it a lot of times. But it's fun to watch them hit it.
Mm-hmm. Cool. You know, when we talked last night, you thought in terms of Baffin and the Laguna Madre as like one entity for fishing. Can you tell me about that?
Well, I think it's, you go, you know, you have an entrance from the Gulf at Port Aransas, and you don't have another entrance till you get to Port Mansfield. And to me, that makes that whole estuary, that whole Laguna Madre, all the way to Port Mansfield, all one particular big unit. And, you know, Baffin Bay just comes off the lagoon right there. It's a shallow water bay. It's just 8 feet deep at its deepest. You've got Yarborough Pass. That bay there is 6 feet deep, you know. So, you know, people don't differentiate that as not being part of the lagoon. Why would you differentiate Baffin Bay? The salinity, you know, Baffin is, I think, one of only, I believe, four hypersaline bay systems in the world, I think. Salinities in the summer can get up, I think, upwards was it 100 parts per, I think 100 parts per thousand, however they measure. I think the Gulf is 33, and they can get up to 100 in that vicinity. And Baffin's all part of that. So to me, when you look at how the water flows, no influx from the Gulf of Mexico, the influences on that entire stretch of water, Baffin is part of that. So I just consider it part of the Laguna Madre.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things going on now are current efforts to restore and conserve the bay. Can you talk about what you would think success is, how you would define success in those efforts?
Well, I think they're making a lot of headway. I think, number one, I like the idea of the trout regulations where they are right now. We only keep three trout. I like that. And I like the size, 17 to 23. I like that. I would like, there's so many guides in the water. If a guide pays for his license, if he wants to keep fish, that's fine. But I don't think a guide should be able to give his clients any fish. I think that should be clamped down upon a little bit, not let them give away any fish. If they want to keep them and take them home, fine. I think that water quality is huge. I think that it would be great if we could come up with some fertilizers. You can't tell them they can't farm on the King and Kennedy ranches. But all those nutrients from their farming efforts, if it rains heavily, which it does here, all those are washed out into the bay, and there's no flush down in the lagoon. There's, because we don't have any entrance to the Gulf of Mexico. We don't have any rivers coming in flushing things out. There's no flush, and so that comes in there. It stays unless you get a hurricane or something to come flush it out. And it'd be great if they could come up with maybe a fertilizer that is ingested by the plants. It's a spray thing. Maybe you'd have to spray it on from either planes or with machines that spray it on the plants themselves, that would dissolve into the plants themselves and not the soil, and that the plants would consume them, and so that they couldn't be washed off. I think that's something, if they can come up with technology to do that sort of thing, would be great, just to try to keep man's influence of different chemicals out of the bay would be tremendous. And then whatever happens with the water quality after that would be nature's effects, you know, and not ours. So we just limit man's impact on the environment in that sense. There's always going to be a lot of people fishing there, and I'm not in favor of making it a no-fish zone. You know, I think it's a place there for people to enjoy. Education processes, maybe have a law. You know, they tried some boat rules in different areas, but I think that I think it would be great to ban running a boat, running your outboard up on plane inside of a quarter mile of the shoreline, which is only 400 yards. You can't run your motor inside 400 yards of the shoreline. Keep people off the shorelines would be great, because the tunnel boats these days, people, you know, you can run them in 2 inches of water. And I run a tunnel boat, but I don't run the shorelines. That's where the fish work, on the shorelines, they work all that. Just stay off of it. Stay a little ways out. And if it's a little rough out there because the wind's blowing 20, then maybe you should have bought a boat with a keel if you don't like that, you know. And don't run over the flats looking for fish. So if we can somehow get people to stay off the flats and off the shorelines, that would really help a lot. That would be huge. So water quality as far as the farming and education with boating, I think, would be a couple of things I'd really like to see.
Do you have people running over you if you're fishing the flats?
I've gotten to where almost where I don't enjoy going down there as much anymore. The price of gas is so high this year, it's not as crowded as it's been. But yeah, and that's the thing, you can't hide anymore. I used to have spots, you know, if I could get two or three shots with a fly rod at fish that are really shallow with their backs out of the water, I'm happy. I don't need to catch 20 fish. I don't even want a school of fish. I like individual fish. But I know there was a time last year in the spring, I was so tired of getting run over. I said, well, I'm just going to go up behind Tar Paper Island, which is southwest of Yarborough. I'm going to go up in there on the sand grass line where nobody runs. Nobody goes over in there. I know there won't be as many fish, but I might could find a big trout up there on the sand I could see, or maybe, you know, find a couple redfish. So I got in there pretty early. I'm in there about 7:30, and just drifting around, and had six boats run over me by 9 o'clock up there. And I'm just like, this is just, I go down there and I get mad. I'm like, why come down here and get mad? So I've actually started fishing the beach a lot more, because at least they're not going to run over you on the beach. Problem is, the beach is tough. We had a pattern in the winter. We caught a lot of really nice trout in the winter, but I've not figured it out yet this summer. I've not done any good at all this summer.
Well, it's been so windy, too.
It has been, but we've had some decent days. And I'm about 0 for my last 4 or 5 trips. It's been a little distant. You ask colors and flies. I've started tying all these different kind of flies, rattling mullet and different types of flies. And I think I need to go throw a plug-in rod a little bit to see if I can catch something, because maybe if I'm not successful with my type of flies, or fly fishing is a little tougher, maybe I could catch some fish on a plug-in rod. I don't know. But I've been pretty hardcore fly fishing so far.
Yeah. Neat. Well, you mentioned teaching your kids how to fish and your son's fishing, but how do you think we can get younger generations to want to be stewards of Baffin Bay?
Education. You got to start with the parents. You know, have to want to be stewards to educate the kids. Otherwise, that any sort of process like that would fall on schools. And I think it's great if the university, or even in high school, if you had a program that taught fishing, or, you know, the ecology and stuff, ecology class, environmental class of some sort, environmental science or something, that included fishing, a section on fishing and how to do that, protect the environment when you do it. But at the end of the day, your best impact is going to come from parents taking their kids fishing, and that they want to protect the environment themselves. And I think that takes time. I think the older generation that kept everything they caught is mostly dying off. And the next generation, which is my generation, is there, where we used to keep everything we caught, but then we changed and started doing this and started paying more attention. And once we're gone, you're into the next generation. I think it's going to gradually get better, but I think it takes time. It's just something you can't change overnight. Mm-hmm.
Well, those were all the specific questions I have, but do you have any more fish stories you want to tell me?
Oh, yeah, I've been hooked a whole bunch of times. My boys like to make fun of me how many times I've stuck a hook in my hand or my arm or whatever. The biggest trout I almost caught, I got a story about my dad. It wasn't in Baffin, but he never caught a double-digit trout. He caught a lot of 28, 29, 30-inch trout, but he never caught one that weighed 10 pounds. And he was wading out in front of the Oso on the one winter on the bayside, and he's in the Navy, so he knows knots pretty well. And he always prided himself on the bowline that he would tie, knot he would tie into his stringer. And he's fishing out there, and he had about a 25-inch trout on his rod. And we had marks on our rods, so inch marks. We had kept a 25, a 28, and a 32-inch mark. And he caught this trout. He's estimated to be 34 inches long. It's the biggest thing he ever seen. It made the 25-inch he had on there, dwarfed it into nothing. And he's got it on the stringer, and he's fishing. And there was another guy wading out there. And the guy says, "Hey, is that your stringer out there?" And he looks, and there's a ball from his stringer. It's about 100 yards away, and his stringer's still tied to him. And the knot had come undone. He called me that night, and I swear he was in tears. I thought he was going to cry. It was awful. But a lot of things started for us back there. Ed Fiore, who played on tour, I mentioned him earlier. We started this game in the land cut. Which we did in Baffin as well, some where we would throw chrome torpedoes. It's a topwater lure with a propeller on the back. And if you work, there's a certain way you can work it. If you pop, 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 you don't stop. You keep it going. It seems to really attract trout. That sound attracts them, and they'll come up. And we caught a lot of big trout on it too, but just trout in general. But they miss it a lot, and because it's on top. And so we started what we call this backhaul game, where you might throw over there and you get a hit and you miss it. And I've got mine in right now. And I said, "Well, I'll get him for you." And I'll throw back in behind you and throw it right there and catch that fish that you just missed. And that sort of backhaul sort of thing, I had Bill Rogers, who was a player of the year on PGA Tour in 82, I think it was, won the British Open. He's down there with us, and fishing with him and Bruce Liske and myself on the boat. And we're back in Alazan around the corner, and we had fished East Clayburgh Point early that morning and only caught a few, and we went around the corner, and we're drifting the shallow flat out there, throwing broken backs, and we're fishing in 18 inches of water, just blind casting, and he had a big swirl, and he missed it, and the boat's drifting. And I said, "Come on, get him, Bill." So we're being very polite, you know, let him reel it in and throw again, but he threw 100 feet past this fish, and I'm sitting there watching. And I'm watching, and the boat's going to get to that fish before his lure is going to get to that fish. And I'm just like, finally, I couldn't stand it. So I just flipped it over, flipped mine over there, and boom, fish hit it immediately and caught it. It was a 28-inch trout, and he was so mad. He was so mad. I stole his fish. I'm like, "What? Your fish was not going to be anywhere near the boat was going to spook it before you could have caught it." So we've had a lot of great times down there, that sort of thing, for sure. And then my boys were down there. We had one time, we had just built a floating cabin that we had down there, and my oldest son, he was 12, and he wanted to go to the cabin for his birthday. And so we went down there and we fished that day and spent that night, and actually went down late that afternoon. We fished the next morning. We were supposed to come back that afternoon. It was both my sons and a friend of theirs. So I had two 12-year-olds and an 8-year-old. And that evening when we got there, I said, "Here, you guys take the boat. You can go over there and go fishing." Two 12-year-olds and an 8-year-old. "I'm going to sit here on the cabin." So they went over there. So then the next morning we went fishing, and I turned them loose out on this flat. And I just kind of fished around the boat, stayed away, and let them go by themselves, see what they could do. And they came back with three limits of redfish. You know, each had their own limit of redfish, which was pretty cool being that age. And we got back to the cabin, and they're like, "You know, we don't want to go home." You know, so I called up my wife and said, I told her, I said, "Yeah, we've kind of, our boat's not starting. I think we need to stay here another night, you know, see if we can get it, work on it, see if we can get it to start." So we ended up spending the night down there, and they had a great time. So we had a lot of enjoyable times down there.
Yeah, neat.
Yeah, it's a great place for family and friends. I met Doug Bird, who was one of the fathers of lure fishing pioneering the Texas coast. I was, me and my dad and another guy were hiding under the pier at East Clayburgh Point, and a thunderstorm came up one morning, and we finally had enough the lightning and stuff. So we jumped in the boat and ran back to one of the cabins back at Twin Palms, and they were there, and there was, Doug was there, and he saw us get out of the boat, and he looked at us, and Doug's originally from Canada, and he looks at us. He's about 5'8" or 5'9", and no wonder you guys are wading that spot, because I'm 6'7" and my dad was 6'4". And he goes, "Now I understand. It made sense, you know." And he says, "No matter how early I go, I can never get to that beach, you guys, or that spot when you guys go fishing." I said, "Yeah, I know. We go pretty early." You know, Doug was a guide, so we became really good friends. Unfortunately, Doug passed away here recently, but he was known as a pioneer of Baffin Bay in that area. One of the first ones to use a trolling motor down there, and strictly no bait, strictly a plug-in fisherman, kind of one of the pioneers down there.
Well, is there anything else you want to tell me about Baffin or fishing or your life? What did I miss?
No, you got most of it. I think that as far relating to fishing, I think it's a great sport. It's a great source of family time, quality time that you can spend together. I do hope in the future that that we become a little better stewards. It's going to be crowded. Hope that people start operating their boats with a little more courtesy and intelligence about what they're doing, because the fish habits have changed dramatically down there. And stay off the flats as far as running a little bit, the shallow water. Don't run the flats so much. Don't go looking for fish that way. And then the water quality. I really hope that that the farming and stuff get to a point where it doesn't influence the water, and get the water back to where it's consistently year in, year out, you know, the water's a lot better. That would be my hopes.
Seems like a good place to stop.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You're welcome.